Okay, people, so it's part two of this week's Echo Chamber, and as promised to you, we look at a new indie joint and then we sit down with the director to talk all the ins and outs of putting it together, his ideas around storytelling. It's a fun conversation, people, trust me. So let us get this started. All right, let's go. Right, people, let's get it popping with this new psychological crazy ass horror that isn't quite what you suspect. That's right, people, let's get into Little Bone Lodge. Okay, people, so Little Bone Lodge, right? It is a new horror thriller, right? Dark, psychological. Thanks to the good people at Signature, they hooked me up with the film. So yeah, I was able to check it out. It is directed by Matthias Horn, and written by Neil Limpow. The film is produced by Mark Lane. Leonora Darby. It is co-produced by Nicholas Chow. Executive produced by Peter Bevan, Simon Crow, Matthew Joiners, and Marina Sarah Jojo. Christopher Carmichael was on music. Job Rennick, cinematography. Niles Howard edited the piece. Nua Meki, production design. Colleen Buck, costume design. Hair and makeup, we have Christine Nicklin Rivett, Chelsea Murphy, Genesis Lowe, and Bridget Gardner. Production management was Tala Hansen. And our cast is Ma is played by Jolie Richardson. Pa is played by Roger Ajibu. We have then got Maisie, played by Sadie Savella. Matty is Harry Cadby. His brother Jack is Neil Limpow. We also have McAllister, played by Cameron Jack. Duncan, played by Ewan Bennett. PC Adams is played by Clifford Samuel. DC Stanton is played by Jamie Melrose. And, well, you can't forget Bella, who's played by Sharon Young. Now, the gist of the story, right? It's set during a vicious storm. Two criminal brothers on the run seek refuge in a desolate farmhouse. Taking the resident family captive, they find the house holds dark secrets of its own. Bum, bum, bum. Now, Matthias, right, had the following to say in a director's statement. All the actors truly got into their characters on set, subscribing to varying degrees of method acting, which I tried to support the best I could and think translated to great performances on set. And while the film is dark and twisted, I wanted to make sure that we can understand the warped logic of each of the protagonists, however psychotic they turn out to be. With Little Bone Lodge, I wanted to do a film where every element is considered placed and choreographed to create tension and mystery and carve the characters into our brains in the most vivid and gut-wrenching way. I also cherish the notion of trying to keep wrong-footing the audience. The warm, loving mother turns out to be someone entirely different from what we anticipated. The villainous brother seems to have a heart of gold, but then reveals his selfish side. The innocent juvenile turns out to be tough as nails. Visually, I wanted to embrace the darkness of the characters and capture the film with dark and moody imagery, full of grit, dirt, and texture. The camera is a character in this story. Shooting one camera handheld allowed me to get close to the actor's eyeline and really feel empathy for them. I aim to heighten the feeling of isolation and hopelessness by contrasting the claustrophobic character close-ups with epic landscapes, which I filmed myself in Scotland. I collaborated with DOP John Jobrenik, and we used an Arri Alexa LF camera and my favorite lenses, the Canon K35S, which are both sharp but have a pleasing vintage flair and character as used in Aliens. We shot wide open as often as possible, again to heighten the character's sense of isolation. For the soundtrack, I worked with my frequent collaborator, Christopher Carmichael, who combined experimental soundscapes with terrifying beats and haunting melodies to draw us into the film. We explored plenty of experimental synth machines, analog instruments like the Viking violin, and makeshift drums. I tried to make the viewer experience an Hitchcockian delight in the twisted darkness of the characters and story. We know something is off, but we don't know what. Dramatic irony, suspense, and the depth of the characters should keep us glued to the screen and want to take the viewer to a place worse than death and serve up a story impossible to forget. Now, people, I will say, after watching this film, I think they managed to do that. Now, on paper, right, we have seen plenty of films about visitors showing up, right, taking people hostage and all of that. So there's a sense of you're suspecting of what is going to come, right? It starts off with this whole family affair. There's a birthday. Seems very nice, you know, very civil, happy, sweet, warm, caring. But there's a storm going on outside, a storm like no other. And that's always an ominous thing in this type of film, right? So when the knock on the door comes, you're just like, I have a feeling this is not going to go well, right? Now, initially, things seem to be going in a certain direction, and then it changes. But here's the thing, right? Where you think, okay, this is going to be this, we take these nice little turns, right? These derailments of the story that send us into these different places. And you have these moments of, yo, what the fuck did just happen there? Wait, what? And that's great, right? That's great, because you like to be wrong-footed in a thriller. No one wants to go, okay, this is going to happen, and then that's exactly what happened, right? There's no surprises. It's no shock and awe. It's just that story. Now, sometimes, you know, because of the acting and the way they told that familiar story, it's still okay. It still works. But you do want that fresh thing, that newness, that intriguement. And Little Bone Lodge, I kind of feel it delivers all of that. Right? Now, this type of film, it definitely weighs on the acting talent you have, right? Because it's all about emotions. When there are secrets involved and things aren't what they seem, you need your cast to be able to give you nuance, be able to layer those emotional outputs. And man, I mean, Jolie Richardson, right? God damn, she kicks ass all the time. So there's no surprise there. But the other actors involved, I mean, crazy talented. You know, we get some superb performances. Harry Cadby is Matty, right? Because his character has EPO, EP, like emotional personality disorder. Yeah, I think that's the way you say it. EUPD. So in a lot of films, right, these sorts of things are played in a certain way. But here, you know, you're like, okay, right? No, it's not a glaring thing, but it works within the story. You know, Sadie. Now, I think there's a big thing here with language, and there's some certain language used at the beginning, which I think when I hear that, I kind of think, I feel something's up. But you're not quite sure. Right, so the arc of Sadie's character, Maisie, is very interesting. You know, we have this wide-eyed, innocent girl. And, right, it's not an easy thing to put across, right? But still with the intrigue, but loving, love for the family and just all of this stuff. And she does a great job. Great job. You know, Neil as the brother Jack, right? Has to show that brotherly love. But then there's that vicious side. Now, there is one moment later in the film where I do kind of feel his character isn't necessarily going to have qualms in doing a certain thing, right? But that aside, Great. Now, I think Roger Ajoub as Pa, he has one of the toughest things here because his character doesn't speak. So everything is through the eyes, which not an easy thing to do. Not an easy thing to do at all. So having an actor that can deliver that kind of performance, that's impressive. Yeah, really is impressive, you know. And so, yeah, this film, boom, it is great. Very great. Dark tone, you know, which adds to that foreboding. Right? Adds to that feel of, oh, things that aren't good will be happening here. Right? This isn't a happy story. This is something else, right? So all of that works. You know, you have the, because, you know, Maddie and Jack have kind of invaded this house. So you have moments where they're grabbing people and forcing. And because we've got this close-up camera work a lot of the time, you really feel it. You really feel it. it is, yeah, like just really well put together and thought out, you know, really well. Now, you do kind of think to yourself, how is this going to end? Right? Because it looks like there is no happy solution here. Right? It's just a mess. But the way it ends has you like, fuck. Oh my gosh. You ain't, you are definitely, people, trust me, you are definitely gonna be on the edge of your seat with this one. You know, you will definitely be on the edge of your seat. It's, yeah, just got enough to keep you hooked all the way. You know, the location is great. It really helps to add to the story. Yeah. It's very confined, but because it's big and, you know, they're in the stables and just these other kind of bits, that helps keep you on your toes. And then just some of these discoveries, let's say, you won't see them coming. Trust me. There is a bit where I'm thinking to myself, something right around, you know what, I ain't even going to say. I feel that will give too much away. People, you know what, just go watch the film. Go watch the film. You will not be disappointed. Trust me. It drops on a Monday, the 22nd of May. Be available on all your favorite streaming platforms. All the information is in the, you know, the episode. So go to the website, right? Episode 225, part one, and you'll find all of that. But people, trust me, you will not be disappointed, right? This isn't your typical, you know, home invasion film. It really isn't. It's, you know, gives you a visage of something and then it pulls the rug away. But in a good way, people. In a good way. So, yes, Little Bone Lodge, go check it out. People, you will not be sorry. Okay, people. So, next up, we sit down with the man behind the camera. It's a great conversation with Matthias Hoon. Okay, so people, let's get into it. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I am here today with Matthias Hoon. We did.
Yes, yeah, well done.
Yeah, we did.
Unanswerable surname. Thank you.
Okay, awesome. Matthias is the director of new psychological horror. Would you call it a psychological horror?
I would say psychological thriller with a horror twist.
Boom. There you go. Psychological thriller with a horror twist. Little Bone Lodge.
Matthias, yes.
Thank you for stopping by. Really appreciate that.
Pleasure's all mine. Thank you. Thank you.
Now, this film, yo, it's a little unexpected, a little creepy, a little crazy. How did it come about? Because it's written by Neil
Limpow.
Limpow. Yeah. So how did the script come to you?
So, you know, Neil and me met at the commercials company I was actually at the time. And, you know, he was working there as an executive. And at the same time, he was he had a long career as an actor and always felt like he wanted to write something or he wanted to be, or he didn't feel like he quite got the roles that he kind of wanted. You know, when you start off, you sometimes always have to do the bit part in a TV show and you never get the meaty role where you can really show off what you can do. And so he started writing, acting and directing a bunch of short films to kind of as a display case of what he could do, what he'd be capable of. And I saw the short films and I thought they were awesome. And then we were like sort of chatting during the lockdown. I had just done a couple of lockdown short films. And he was doing the voiceover for that. And we were sort of, you know, we were starting to chat. Hey, so what else could we do together? Because we got on well, you know, there was real sort of chemistry there. And we sort of loved chatting about movies. And he kind of was came up with the idea, why don't we write or develop a project together that we could shoot during lockdown, or like, you know, that's small and contained, and it's like a thriller with a small set of characters, so we could get it done and we could sort of just make something sort of contained and small in this kind of crazy time. And, you know, that was all music to my ear, because my first two movies were exactly the opposite of that idea. You know, Cockneys versus Zombies had like a ensemble cast of 10 people, half of which are like over 70 years old, plus crowds of zombies, car crashes, bus crashes, and it's on a boat as well. So all the things you shouldn't do on a low budget, basically, that I did on my first film. And then my second film, ended up me going to China with, you know, sometimes 1,000 people on set, you know, and 15 massive action sequences. It was the Lupin production, you know, and time travel and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. So for me, like, I felt like I'm doing the reverse of a film, trajectory where I start with a really crazy big project and then go, hey, wait a second, I should do that really small contained film. And you know, I think, really I wanted to do it as well because, you know, I felt like having time to work with the actors, having time working out like a character arc for each character in a film, you know, without having too many characters to kind of worry about, was something that I really enjoyed doing and really sort of felt I haven't been able to showcase yet in my first two movies. And it was really important to me to make a movie that felt, you know, psychologically deep and had like the time to really take proper care to develop the characters and show, you know, take the viewer into a small and contained world where, you know, various dark, weird characters unravel. So, you know, and then sort of Neil started pitching ideas to me and we sort of settled on this two criminals on the run thing. In the end, we kind of try to push it as dark and weird as possible. And I don't want to give away too much before you see it. But like, I was really keen that we would take the story to somewhere that the viewer really doesn't see coming. And that's all I'm going to say.
Yeah. Yeah. When you say you thought about trying to take it to that dark place, I think you went there. I think you succeeded with that. Because, you know, like, Two Criminals on the Run, it's a concept that we have seen in countless films, TV shows, read in books. You know what I mean? It's something that we know. But you're watching this and you're like, okay, I think I see where they're going. And then it's just like, yo, what the fuck? Like, oh, shit. I didn't realize that was gonna... Oh, my gosh. You know what I mean? You go through those emotions. So I think... Yeah, you did a really good job with that.
Thank you. Thank you.
No worries. It's like, sorry. No.
Go ahead. I was going to say, you know, it was Neil's first feature film screenplay. And to his credit, he really knocked it out of the park. You know, I was so happy when he delivered the first draft. I was a little bit nervous because, you know, I thought, you know, I don't know if he's going to be able to do it or not. And he did. You know, very much so. So I think, you know, we were all very happy with what he brought together. And I think all the kind of emotions and psychological depth he channeled into all the characters. So
Now, this being his first, and, you know, you've already done some big scale films, right? What did you notice a different, like, was there a big difference in the way he approached script writing to how you approach script writing?
Well, I think what is interesting is that Neil as an actor really works very much on a character level. So he works from the character out, which is kind of the best way to write. You know, I think, you know, often in commercial feature filmmaking, you know, it's often about the concept. So you have to have a concept that kind of you can sell in one sentence and then kind of make everything else work for that, you know. And I've kind of, obviously Cockneys versus Zombies is a high concept. You know, other projects that I've sort of sold or set up often are high concept. You can pitch them, people go like, okay, yes, I want to see that movie. But what makes Neil special is that he really, you know, he lives in the characters as he writes them. And I feel that's why it's sort of so vivid what comes out. And also he really knows the backstory and the depth of what's going on in them and in their minds. So I think that's what I really appreciate about his writing.
Okay. Oh, that's cool. Like it in the you know, we got sent through the director's statement and all of that kind of blurb. And you say you wanted to do a film where every element is considered, placed, and choreographed to create tension and mystery and carve the characters into our brains. Which, you know, like I think sometimes we hear these things, right? And you go, no, that sounds great. And then you check out the finished project and it's like, I'm not quite sure that actually happens. But with this, I do believe that you're kind of, it's a bit like Memento, right? Where at the beginning you're with Guy Pearce and you're like, oh man, poor dude. But by the end you're like, what a piece of shit. I can't believe I like this. Like, he's not good, you know? And so you're with these characters, and like that first scene when we meet them and it's the cake and, you know, everything just seems really nice and wholesome. And then everything kind of goes in the directions it goes. And so I think you are with them and you're like, boom, you're changing as the story goes, but you're like really wanting to find out. You're really wanting to be like, yo, I hope that person gets through, and I hope they're not this. And yeah. So I think you did a really good job of doing that, but like, what does that take? You know, how do you instill that into the end project? Because, you know, obviously it's not an easy thing to do.
Yes, so that's a very big, far-reaching question.
Yes, sorry, I went on a little bit.
Well, I mean, in terms of, I would say, let's start at character. You know, I think before everything, you need to be able to, you know, empathize and understand the characters. And I think what makes this project and the script so exciting, I think, is that even how, you know, however twisted and psychopathic and sociopathic a character turns out to be, all of them have like a really good reason why they're that way. And we sort of understand the twisted logic of why they're doing what they're doing. And I think for that reason, you know, there's moments in the film where you can identify with everyone in there, whatever they've done, because you still understand, okay, this was done out of love, even though it's love gone bad or a twisted kind of logic behind it, you know? And I don't want to give anything away, so I'm talking general, but like, yeah. So that's kind of really, you know, like pure evil is evil that you don't understand. So for me, like an antagonist that is just, you know, devious for no reason, that's kind of something like in real life and in movies, that's just sort of, to me, like the depth of hell, you know? And I think in Little Bone Lodge, we there is pure evil, but you understand it. And it's sort of something that you could imagine, you know, you can see the trajectory of how you could get there. All of the characters are flawed, have like childhood traumas and certain things that happen to them, and they work through that in the film, basically. So that's the character level, you know, like being with the characters, you know, keeping revealing truths about them that we didn't see coming. And then in terms of the, you know, the blocks of storytelling, now, you know, there's a lot of hints, like even right at the opening, that, you know, pay off later and show what, you know, subtly hint that something might be happening. But like, you know, at that point, you have to decide as a filmmaker, how obvious or how subtle do you make those hints? And I think I've been told on second watching, people kind of understand, or like there's a lot of nuance that comes out that you don't see, you know, don't really realize when you watch it the first time. So I was glad to hear that, because, you know, that's exactly the kind of thing, is you want to plant those ideas, but you don't want to give people a good idea or any idea what might happen. I've read, like, someone saw the trailer and went, like, I don't need to see the film now. And I wanted to reply, well, but the trailer hasn't actually given away what happens in the film. You think it has, but it does go so much further than what you think. But, like, you know, I also don't want to really do any talking back on the internet. Never a good thing. But, like, so, you know, so that process, you know, you kind of, it starts at script stage. So, you know, again, Neil did a really good job at sort of laying the breadcrumbs of what's going to happen. And then it kind of keeps refining during storytelling. And, you know, it's sort of, that's where mise-en-scene comes in, when you stage the scenes and you kind of try to, you know, try to add some hints, you know, in the background, foreground, or like, you know, how you place the camera to, you know, make the viewer kind of figure out certain things and not figure out certain things, or just generally have the feeling that there's something always around the corner. For example, our contained farm location, I thought was so great, because actually, unlike, you know, a sort of, you know, you can have contained and you just look into three walls and you see everything that's happening, and that's definitely contained, not very cinematic. But like, what I loved about the location is there was always like a layer or a sort of a bend around a corner or another thing that you could feel was just happening further back. You never quite see the end of the location. So there's always a corridor leading somewhere else. So subliminally, the viewer always knows, okay, there's secrets here. There's other things that we don't know about, which is sort of a feeling I wanted to evoke throughout the film. And then, you know, script level, you plant the seeds, then you work with the actors, of course, as well, scene by scene, you know, to kind of maybe, you know, in the subtle looks and thoughts, and often it's the discrepancy of what's being said and what the actor or character is thinking, where you see there's something else going on. So you plant those things subtly, so the viewer knows, wait, the character's thinking something, but we don't know what it is, and they're saying something else. So keep them on edge that way. And then in the edit, of course, you kind of take things out and put things back in. That's where, like, you know, especially when you've just finished the film, no one's seen it, and you kind of just kind of, because you're so close, you think, well, I know everything. Mm-hmm. Then you have to get really logical and scientific about, okay, we need to put this thing in. Actually, maybe this thing is overstating what's going on, so let's take it out. And then you show it to friends who give you feedback if they got it or not got it. And, you know, the worry also is, like, if you're too sparse, that people just sort of don't understand it and you sort of lose them. So that's the balance there. And then finally, for the tension, also the music is very important to me. And I try to make it so the music is as unmanipulative as possible. It's more like it's almost like a sound bed, like a sound design that wraps around the viewer. And sort of occasionally there's certain themes, the Little Bone Lodge theme or Matty's theme, that kind of repeat and sort of build through the film as we sort of get to know the characters and as they change. So we added a lot of subtle cues there that I think you won't even know that you're being a little bit manipulated. Also, when you're like, when I really wanted the viewer to kind of, there's a moment when Jack and Mama sort of have a heart to heart, and it almost felt to me that in a parallel universe they would potentially become a couple, and I thought, and then it won't happen, it doesn't happen, but I wanted to just the viewer to feel for one moment, okay, there is a love story coming, and that's kind of when music kind of helps to just give you like a little subtle cue, and hopefully without being too manipulative and obvious about it. That sort of thing. So there's a lot of, you asked a big question, so I've had a lot of disparate answers on, you know, how like the few of all the elements that, you know, that go in. And then I guess also sort of what's often important is, or what I was really keen on is making sure that the location is a character in the movie. You know, you have the location and the weather, which is really important to create tension. And the storm that's raging across the highlands, and the house that's sort of being battered by this biblical storm. That was something that's actually really difficult to put together, because we didn't have like a, you know, a massive big movie budget where you could just sort of have five megaton water trucks and like rain machines everywhere and everything. So like, we had a few rain machines, so there's a couple of days where we kind of, you know, did our 1,000 liters in a minute kind of rain that kind of gives you heart palpitations, because you only have like 20 seconds before the water runs out as you're shooting, that sort of thing. But then also like we did a lot of close-ups that we actually shot, like just actually some here in my office or in a mini studio afterwards. And then, so there's lots of really nice, evocative, rainy close-ups. And then also, I went to Scotland and I filmed in Glencoe and the Isle of Skye, just myself with a drone and a small camera. And that was sort of all, to just capture the sort of the large scale of these sort of foreboding mountainscapes in the middle of nowhere in Scotland that just felt like perfect to make the characters felt isolated in the middle of this sort of dark and edgy kind of landscape. Mm. And it was very spiritual for me, traveling in Scotland, you know, getting up at 4 a.m. in the morning to catch the sunrise, and then sort of being there, you know, just when sun broke, and seeing kind of those landscapes all on my own before anyone else was there, and then sort of traveling on to the next one and getting sunset and doing it again. It was great, a great time, and really fell in love with Scotland over and over again, actually. And the whiskey was good as well. It helped with the concentration.
Yeah, need some good whiskey there. Oh, nice, man. Like, did you know it was going to be a farmhouse from the beginning, or was the location something that came to you later on?
No, it was definitely always a farmhouse. I think we started looking for locations like all over the UK, so Scotland, Wales, everywhere else in between. And then in the end, we didn't find the right location in Scotland. And, you know, partly because some of the locations in Scotland would have been like 2 hours from the nearest hotel. You know, it would have been sort of logistically so impossible to shoot there that in the end it was sort of, in the end we ended up ironically really near London at the first location we looked at. I remember we were like sort of going, oh yeah, we're just going to look at this sort of out of duty, you know, so we have something in case, you know, until we actually find the proper one. So we looked at this first location and we're like, oh yeah, you know, so in theory, this would be perfect. And obviously we don't want to go for it because it's the first location, but it just, everything really works here, doesn't it? And then we're like, yeah. So we're just hypothetically speaking, we're okay here. And then we started looking at lots of other locations. And in the end, we were like, oh yeah, first one is perfect, you know, because it's this, it was this really big farm, sort of near London, where the house that we filmed at was the farmer's grandparents, and they had passed away about 8 years previously, and they left the house as it was and just used it as a location. So I had this sort of really eerie feeling of just sort of old-fashioned, not been renovated history, And also it was kind of much, actually much grander than most other farm places that we looked at. And, you know, as you know, in film, you know, sometimes this sort of small, dingy location might be feeling right when you, when you're in there, but then when you have to put like cameras in there and crew, and you know, suddenly you realize, oh, you need something much bigger to kind of be able to film it properly. Otherwise, you're sort of on a wide angle lens and it doesn't look very cinematic, you know. So it turned out to be the perfect location. And then, you know, our production designer, Noor Mekki, came in and really sort of gave it the final lick with picking the right wallpapers and props in there. And sort of, I guess, and big shout out to her to find my favorite little thing in the film, which is this sort of ticking cuckoo clock, a sort of toy that's in there. And I just sort of asked her, I want to just have something weird that isn't a clock that we can just put in there that has sort of just an odd resonance and we're not quite sure what it is. So it's like a, just this little bird that goes tick, 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 tick. I want to see if anyone, you know, send me a message what you think it means, and then we'll I'll tell you the truth.
Well, make sure you do that, people. I just thought, you know, tonally, like, it was really interesting, you know, because, yeah, you get a sense that something isn't quite right, but it's, you know, it starts off with the storm and everything like that. It's just like, well, I mean, there's a storm, so it could just be, but there was a, it's the use of certain language at the beginning that had me thinking a little bit, but still, you're not sure. You're not quite sure what's up at first. So it was, very intriguing to see how everything unfolded. I know, Matty has EUP. I feel I've said that wrong. What is it again? It is... EUPD. Yes, EUPD. Now, was that, like, how did that come into the story and the need for that with that character?
Okay, so I think, so like, it's EUPD, emotionally unstable personality disorder. Now, we like Neil and me talked about this at very great length, because, you know, we all felt like, okay, it's really, you know, it's a sensitive subject to bring a character into a story that has something like EUPD. But we wanted to, you know, we wanted to embrace that just as a character choice. And I think we brought on a sensitivity advisor called Quentin, who we talked to at great length about how do we handle this. So, you know, that so we're sensitive to everyone who has EUPD and the community at large. And I think what sort of, what was really key and what I sort of really latched onto is, you know, when you cast a character that has any sort of, that is neurodiverse, the mistake people often do is make the neurodiversity a point in the story. And we try to do is like to, you know, to have it as part of his character, but not really mention it, you know. Just another character, you know, like, for example, like, I mean, people would like to see, I don't know, like an autistic character in a TV show, where him being autistic or her being autistic is not the point. It's never really talked about. You know, it's just another normal character in a story. And I think that's kind of maybe what we should push to do more of in general. And I think, it's always, you know, it's difficult as a filmmaker when you cast or you, when you create characters like that, you don't want to get, you know, into a, you know, a situation where people accuse you that you weren't respectful of the community that you're portraying. And it's a really, it's a complicated place to navigate. But I think at the same time, it's got to be navigated because, you know, because everyone deserves and should be represented in film. And I think, yeah, so the long and short answer is the key is to treat every character respectful and not make a neurodiversity part of actually or the point of the story, or you know, let's just show them as people like you, like everyone else, basically. There we go.
Yeah, no, I really appreciated that, right? Because as you said, usually there's a scene or something where this thing becomes a real pivotal part of the story and, like, you know, everything that goes on. And it's just like, ugh. You know, it's always sold like everyone with this acts like this. And it's just, that's just not true. It's not true. And you get these blanket statements of like, oh, yes, people with autism, they think this. And it's just like, not everyone. Like, what are we doing here? And so it becomes so frustrating. And I think it does a crazy disservice to everything, you know. So I like the fact that he's just a guy in a film, right? And it's not, oh, well, this and the EPD is because of this and blah, blah, blah. It's just like, no, he's just the guy's brother and he's just in the film doing his thing. And I thought that was very well handled.
Thank you. Yeah, no, absolutely. And he's got the happy ending as well.
Yeah, I have to say, I didn't know how you were going to win this. And when it all kind of pans out, it's just like, fuck. You know what I mean? It's just like, what? There's, I think you could do technically two films, like looking at the aftermath type of thing, which would be completely different films to Little Bone Lodge, you know what I mean? Because, like, man, like, what do you do after something? Like, it's just, oh, I don't want to say too much, but yeah, like,
yes, damn. Like, already, like, no, we haven't spoiled anything, so but like, let's not spoil anything for sure.
Yeah, no, for sure.
You see, I mean, there's definitely ideas for sequels, should it come that way. So in that vibe, everyone, please go and buy the film, then we'll get a sequel.
No, that's interesting that you have thought about what could come next. Because I think sometimes with stuff like this, it's just like, let's just do this. And you feel that when a sequel comes, you're like, was it really? I don't know if it was really. You know, I remember I read The Hunger Games and I was like, you know, as a young adult, but it's fine. It's better than a lot of them.
Yeah.
And then Catching Fire came out and I was like, well, the first one was fine. So look, I'll check it. And I was just like, I don't really see the point of this. I didn't see a need for these other aspects in the story and these weird love triangles and all of that. And you know, sometimes wonder, like, was there actually an original thought of this being a trilogy, or was it the success, the thing that was like, oh, we want more. And now you have to think of, oh, where am I taking this? You know, what am I going to do?
Yeah, I mean, I guess with Hunger Games, to be fair, the first one was like a battle royale movie, but it didn't take on what they were called the government. And I think that's kind of, I felt, okay, yeah, now you got to take it to the next level and start the revolution. So I got that, but like there was a beauty and a sort of like containedness to the first film that sort of was lost on first book that was lost in the ones, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, I don't mind a revolution. Right, there's a guy called Pierce Brown, I think, and he's got this series Red Rising, and it deals with like a caste system, and then they're trying to overthrow. And I really enjoyed how that first trilogy unfolded and the story went and everything like that. I thought that was handled very well. I very much, you know, that's always intriguing to. You know,
so. Didn't they want to turn that into a movie? Is it Blood Red Rising, or is it? I haven't read it, but like,
no. So it's just Red. I can't remember if the series is called Red Sun or hold on a second. Red.
So good.
Sorry.
Right. So, guys, sorry, we're going to just interrupt for a social media break. We all both have to check our Instagrams. I've got a little call to make. Oh, the dopamine hit there. How many likes? Okay. Now we're back. What's happening?
So, it's Red Rising. And,
yeah.
Okay. I think he has sold the rights for a film or TV series. Nothing's happened yet with it.
That old story, what can I say?
Yeah.
So hard. It's like making a movie is always like stealing fire from the gods. You know, you kind of, you know, you think you got the option, you kind of, you're ready to make it, and then, you know, then you don't find the right cast, or you know, the financing falls through, and yeah. So many things, so many hurdles at which you can fall when you put a film together. So the one thing when I started making movies is like I stopped criticizing other filmmakers, because it was like, oh yeah, it's so hard to make film. Everyone who's done it deserves a congratulation, you know. That definitely changes when you've been through that. And now third time around, so it feels like it's not a hoax anymore. It's happening.
Yeah. I know. There's so many projects that you hear about, or like books that have been sold, and then just nothing happens. Because I know, it's Peter Abramovich's Rivers of London series got picked up, but nothing so far. And Brian McKellen's Powder Made series picked up, but just nothing. And you're just like, oh, those would be great as a like TV series, but yeah, just nothing. But you know, how does it feel for you, this being your third film? Like, you've done you've worked in TV, you've done shorts, film. Like, how does it feel, like, with all of the stuff you've done telling stories, do you think that you've got to the point where you know what you're doing, or do you still feel you're learning? Are there like aspects that you really want to explore?
Well, I think so. Like, you know, I feel less angsty about it than before. I wouldn't say I feel like I know what I'm doing, because it is sort of a lifelong learning thing. But there's this, you know, there's definitely a certain ease around set that you get. And especially, like, to be honest, my second film was such a crazy, huge undertaking. And, you know, it was sort of definitely something where I grew as a filmmaker. And you know, you learn where you stress and where you don't stress, and you learn how to extend your energies, and you know what matters. And I think in the end, it comes down to what's in front of the camera and the actors, and that's it, you know. And I think making sure that the stories emotionally connect with the viewer, and that that you get drawn in, all of that, you become more confident with what you're doing and how you're doing it. And I'm sort of definitely a filmmaker. I sort of started off doing everything myself, from, you know, camera editing, sound, music, writing, everything. And I feel like that sort of hands-on thing is something I really love. So, like, in Little Bone Lodge, I was super hands-on. You know, I filmed the plates, but then also, you know, played like the Viking violin on the soundtrack, which is sort of a weird three string wooden box that sounds like you're sort of torturing a violin or something. It's a funny instrument, but I just love getting my hands dirty and like being really involved in sort of every aspect of it. And I think, so moving forward, it feels like, I mean, there's definitely a lot more I want to explore. I think I'm very happy with the, you know, the tone and the sort of look and the feel and the performances in Little Bone Lodge. And I think I want my next film, I want it to be exactly that. And I'm going to also introduce back a little bit more sense of humor and fun and mix the two together. So and then the fusion of everything I've done is complete.
Okay. Yeah. 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 There's not really any fun in Little Bone Lodge.
There's a little bit of dark fun. Yeah. But like, yes, it's definitely, no, it's sort of interesting because, when you make a horror comedy, the complicated thing is that once you've done it, marketeers look at it and go like, oh yeah, we can't sell a horror comedy with action. We can only sell a horror comedy that's a romantic comedy with horror. And you go, okay, so, you know, and it's so like people sort of don't appreciate how difficult it is to make something that has that mixes tone and comedy and action, horror and heist movies and time travel, yada, yada, yada. It's really hard to make that work. So I wanted to, with Little Bone Lodge, I wanted to just have a very straight tone and purpose. I was like, okay, this is just going to be tense, claustrophobic, dark, down the line. Because I really wanted to, I had like sort of done tone crossover films a lot before, and I just felt like now I'm just going to go all out one direction, and that was fun. It was good. That said, with AI coming after us now, I think it's time to cross over things again and make things that you know are as unexpected as you could possibly think. Well, which is also a Little Bone Lodge. You kind of you'd go to a place that you don't see coming.
Yes. Yeah. No, I think, Tony, this really did work. And I think a big part of that was the performances. Some great frigging performances, man. Like, how did the casting work on this one?
Well, so I think, right from the beginning, of course, we Neil was always the corner stone with playing Jack. And I had seen his short films and knew from the beginning that he would be perfect for the role. And also because, you know, he wrote the script, he sort of lived his own character in his own head many, many times before he came on screen. And so he really... like knew exactly what he wanted to do. And, you know, at that point it's sort of often just about me making sure that the energy on set is kind of enabling the actors to, you know, be in character and truthful and completely immerse themselves in who the character is. So, and then adjust, you know, if there's sort of things that don't quite resonate or don't quite feel truthful. So that was kind of the process with Neil. And, you know, he really knocked it out of the park. I think, you know, he's sort of intense when he gets close to camera and like sort of grabs people's faces and really sort of went for it. And I loved that. You know, the next step, of course, we did actually a little prologue that you can track down on the internet, which is sort of set before a few weeks before the events of the film. And that was sort of his audition tape slash short film, which is awesome. And then with that, we approached Jolie Richardson, and I made a little video for her, you know, just to talk her through why I thought she was perfect and a little bit about the project and everything. And she liked the video, she liked the script. And then we sort of waited for her to have an opening in her schedule. And then when that happened in between the Netflix shows, et cetera, that she's on, we snuck in there and made the film together. So with her, I mean, I finished casting. So like, you know, Sadie Sovereign, Harry Cadby, Roger Clifford, Sharon, they all came around with just through traditional casting, basically. The thing about, for example, Sadie, she was just, it's her first feature film, and she was just heads and shoulders above. She was just, her audition tape was just astoundingly good. So, I knew immediately, okay, she's perfect for the role. And same with Harry Cadby, his first feature film, but then he was just so enigmatic on tape. And we were still doing Zoom auditions only at the time, you know, not in person. He just sort of, you know, just had that sort of feeling of vulnerability, but strength, slight edge of madness when he needed to. So he had just basically all the things, the qualities of the character that we needed, you know, sort of that's Matty. Maisie is kind of a 17-year-old girl who's sort of still 12 in her head. So that innocence was really important. And Sadie really captured that. There was, for example, a few people that did read through with the script. So Jamie Melrose, who's playing DC Stanton, was one of the people that helped us right at the beginning, and she did a great job as well. So yeah. Oh, and check out Ewan Bennett as well. He was in the prologue, he's in the film. Cameron Jack, so I'm going to name drop everyone. I was very happy with how it all came together. And, you know, I think, you know, the process is really, you know, directing, working with actors is sort of a multi, like everything in life, a multi-level kind of endeavor. So at first, of course, you need to understand who the characters are, you know, what their kind of motivations are, the backstory, what's kind of, you know, in the head holding them back. And sort of go into scene by scene work, where in every scene you need to tell the actors, okay, you know, where are you coming from? What happened just before that might inform how you act in the scene? What do you want out of the scene, and what's in your way? So that's kind of the basic acting directives that you get. But then more than that, you know, I guess you do the rehearsal, and I kind of think about how to block it, how to stage it, how to put the camera so the image also reinforces what the characters are feeling or what I want the viewer to feel. But then also it's sort of really important to make sure that every actor's performance feels really truthful and authentic. And, you know, the simplest acting lessons, it's so simple yet so hard, but acting is about thinking the character's thoughts in the moment. So if you think what the character would be thinking, your face, your voice, your body language, everything will automatically fall in line and communicate what that is, you know. But to kind of, to have that, you know, focus and imagination to be a different person, to think a different person's thought in the moment, not be distracted, is kind of the difficult bit. But you know, often, you know, again, I try to just create the energy on set. So it was very much a method kind of set. And it started with Harry Cadby, who who really showed us, because sometimes method acting is sort of a little bit, has a reputation. But Harry was method acting, showed us how to do it, because he was really in character, in prep for the scene, or throughout the day, if it was a really difficult day, always in character, in the Matty character, a little bit sometimes rolling around on the floor and muttering to himself. And but then as soon as we're done, he's like, okay. Then he turned into chirpy, chippy, cheeky Harry Cadby again, and, you know, good as gold, friends with everyone. So so he was back to normal. So in a way, he did method, but then also knew when to switch back into his normal mode. And I think everyone was inspired by that. So we all ended up being method, including me. Sometimes I felt sad. Sadie had a crying scene, and she was crying all day long. And then, I kind of then also tried to give teary energy, because, you know, then I know that she's not going to lose her concentration. So I was just feeling really sad all day long. And, you know, and then you have a set that's just sort of has this dark mood. But you know, on purpose and, you know, respectfully and all of that, you know. And it just, I felt like helped get everyone, helped everyone to do their best work, basically. And often that's sort of something people don't talk about, that the energy that the director gives each actor and each crew member is really key to how a film comes together. You know, it's sort of something nebulous, but like on a comedy, I'm fun and bubbly and fast and yada, yada, yada. On a film like this, it's about sort of keeping like very serious and straight and focused energy that's appropriate to the scene you're doing. You know, and interestingly, you know, when actors do think thoughts that are different to what they're saying, that's when you get performances where, you know, the viewer knows that there's something going on in the actor's head, but you can't quite put your finger on it, or they can read it, or, you know, you can create like a depth of a performance. Mm. I mean, it was most hard for Roger, who plays Pa, who literally only has one line. And like we spoke about, like I gave him like separate scripts to like let him know what his character is thinking at this point, so he could just try to emote that from his eyes. And so he had like at one point like had an easy job and a really, really, really hard job on set. So and he really did a great job. And, you know, he also is one of the loveliest people on the planet. So he kept all the crew happy and chirpy, which is also an important part. So yeah, kudos to Roger, big up.
Like, how was that casting, right? Because with that character, you like having to ask someone to be like, okay, so I need this, but you can't talk. Like, what was that like trying to find that role? Because I imagine that can't be an easy thing to do.
Yeah, I think well, it's exactly that conversation that you know, a lot of the life of the character is internal, so it is all about acting in the eyes and, you know, the emotions you sort of get out of that, and then the fear or like you know, things like that that can help communicate what the character is feeling, but without giving too much away too early in the film. So like and Roger was just very game for it and really, you know, excellent in the role, so, you know, that's why I went with him.
No, I think you said some interest, because I think sometimes like there's certain directors, you know, like Adam Sandler, like Judd Apatow, and, you know, Martin Scorsese, they work with a lot of actors who they've, you know, made numerous films with. So you kind of get the feeling that set must be good, right? That they all get on and there's a good vibe there. Mm. But I think I haven't really heard a lot of people put it into words how you did. You know what I mean? About how the changing that mood on the set to reflect the scene, to help the actor stay in that scene. Mm. I think that's a really interesting, because I always wonder, right? Because with this, I wondered, how do you get these performances? What do you do? Do you use music? Do you like have these conversations with the actors to be like, yo, so this is what I want you to invoke? Have you watched this film? Like that kind of performance, or read this book, and, you know, that character kind of embodies what your you wonder. What tools, what resources do you use to get those performances? So I thought that was interesting. Like, the, you know, keeping a sad kind of mood to help Sadie keep her sad mood. That's interesting.
Yeah, no, thank you. Absolutely. I mean, I think music helps. And I try not to, I try never to kind of go, you know, think of this actor, think of that actor. I try to find it in, you know, in the... help them find it in their own heart, and so it comes from inside. But like so I think when I touch this, I'm probably gonna get like a sound thing, but like anyway.
Oh no, it's cool.
But like I think it's sort of trying to find the emotions that you know, instead of, you know, hey, I want you to be sad, you need to, you know, it's trying to help the actor find the thoughts they need to think to get to that point, you know, and it can be personal. But finding the, you know, the truth of why something's happening in the scene, and then helping kind of bring that out is kind of what I like to do. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think and we haven't really spoken about Jolie Richardson, of course, who is kind of was like a great force to have on set, because she was very much so professional that, you know, like she had a scene where she had to cry, and like literally on every single take that we did, like a tear started rolling down at the same moment. And it was just like so, you know, precise and great, you know, and I was totally in awe with her. So she's very sort of, you know, she's very technical in her like precision, how she can do it. But then at the same time, she's really truthful and intense and in the way she acts. So she's like, she was really great to watch and kind of witness how she did it. And she was also really generous with all the other actors, you know, because acting is reacting and acting together and sort of giving each other the energy that you need to give your best performance. And she was great with that. You know, she was really like a team player, really, you know, and I always look for that, but like elevating everyone else's game as well. So it's just a pleasure to work with her. So,
I mean, it was a magnificent performance. I think it's sometimes when you haven't seen someone in something for a while and you forget the performances they can give. So watching, I haven't seen her in anything for a little while. And so it was just like, oh, shit. Okay. And then you just watch and like, oh my God. Like, oh, that's so, there's with so many of these characters, the depth that they have to go to, right?
Yeah.
Different swings that they have to like portray to the viewer. It's done so well. And I mean, as you said at the beginning, right, it's that darkness, but I think it's like, because when you just look at so many people in history and you'd be like, oh, they were a piece of shit, that was not a nice person, but then you look into the things they did and why they did it, and you're like, I mean, I can see where they're coming from. Very fucked up, and it's a weird way to think, but in their mind they're doing this, and you're like, oh yeah, that their actions make sense if you have that mindset, right? So like everyone, I think no one is really probably straight evil. Right, everyone's got a justification for what they do. So it's like being able to capture that and see someone put that out there in a way where you can be with them for a little bit and at times and understand, but you're still like, oh, but that's so fucked up. And you get that from her. It was so like, just some of the things she says towards the end, and you're just like, that's a fucked up mentality, but I understand where you're coming from, but damn, like, that's not good.
Yeah, so, it's sort of it's sort of, there's an emptiness and a love inside at the same time, and that's sort of the interesting part of that. I don't want to give, you know, I don't want to say anymore, but like and I think that's why it was interesting for Jolie to play the part, because it was sort of a dark part, but it starts as like sort of the perfect maternal figure, and I think she was sort of excited to go on that journey and have that arc. So that's all I'm going to say. And it's sort of she was also very collaborative, and you know, try like on every scene, hey, what's the best version we can get out of this? What's the best version we can create here with this scene? And always added really good ideas, and always sort of for the better of the movie, you know, which is sort of really something that's sort of great when you have collaborators like that.
Yes, no, definitely. definitely. Mm. But you can work with talented people, but they can be very selfish at times, and it can be difficult.
Mm.
But when you get stuff from them, it's just, oh, that's great. But it's just like, it can be a struggle.
Yes, exactly.
Now, one thing that you said earlier about the trailer and how someone watched it and was like, oh, I've seen the film now, right? Which is it's an interesting thing to say, because I do feel that there's a lot of trailers that give away the story. So when you were putting all of that, like, how did you feel about putting the trailer together, and how do you feel about trailers in general, and how much you should say to entice someone?
Well, it's a really difficult thing, because it's so hard to get people to go watch a film, you know? So I think the reason so much is given away in trailers is because, you know, in a way you want to make people feel like, okay, you're not going to get let down when you watch this film. It's going to be good. There's going to be lots of stuff happening. This is the hook, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Because you don't get people just sort of going to watch a film just because it's on at the cinema anymore. And I think that's part of the reason why trailers have started giving away so much, because people's time is short, and they want to know that when they start watching a film, that it's going to be worth their while, I think. So obviously you try to not do that as a filmmaker. I think, you know, we sort of, in the process of making our trailers, we definitely went like a little bit too far and then pulled it back and tried to sort of hint enough so people know that there is going to be something coming, but not showing what it actually is, kind of thing. So because you want to tease people that they feel like intrigued and curious and, you know that it's more than just a home invasion movie, but not sure what more is coming. So, yeah, I feel like, about the trailers, it's obviously it'd be great if we could just release a movie without a trailer and people go and see it, you know? I mean, and that's often the best thing when you don't know anything about a film and you just go into the cinema and you're like, oh, wow, this is amazing. But that doesn't happen anymore, does it?
You know what, right? That happened to me twice.
Mm.
I mean, well, it's happened to me more times with film festivals because, you know, I have no clue and I just go into things, right?
Mm.
But I remember growing up, The Matrix and Gladiator.
Oh, wow, yeah.
I knew nothing. I knew they were making a Gladiator film. I'd heard about it, and I love, you know, history. And I read a lot of, like, Roman Greek history and just mythology and just all of that kind of stuff. So I loved all of that. So I remember hearing they were doing this Roman thing and thinking, oh yeah, look forward to that, you know. There's like Clash of the Titans and, you know, all of that was like,
yeah,
I loved it. That was like films I just loved growing up. So I remember but then I kind of forgot all about it. And one day a friend was like, oh, do you want to go to the cinema? I'm like, yo, I don't even know what's on. It's just like, no, it's just a good film. Let's go and watch it. And I remember sitting down, and the way Gladiator opens up with that fight in church and the arrows. And yes. I'm just like, wow. And just being like, oh my gosh. And then the other time, same friend called me up and said, like, yo, let's go to the cinema. I'm like, what? And he's like, there's something called The Matrix. I'm like, I've never heard of it. I'm like, yeah, all right, whatever. I'm good. I've got nothing else to do. Let's go. And just sitting down and just watch it and be like, whoa. Oh my God.
Yeah, The Matrix would have been a good one to discover.
Like the one time at a film festival where I probably should have watched a trailer, I remember watching going into Spencer, and I thought it was a spy film. And so when it all over and the palace and they're bringing all the things, I'm like, okay, something's gonna go down here. Oh, shit. Yeah, okay. And then I'm just like, hold. And then as it went on, I'm like, hold on, is this about Diana? Ah, fuck.
All right. Fair enough. I think I get that. I would have been disappointed had I wanted like Mission Impossible with Diana.
But I try not to watch trailers now. Is I think they're just shot in a way which, you know, can just spoil. Because I remember, because, you know, when I do this, right, it's like to, when I put all the information on the website, so I put the trailer there. So finding the trailer, I remember when I watched Us. Mm-hmm. So I hadn't watched the trailer. And so when I had to find the trailer, I saw a bit of it, and they showed this scene with the mirror. And I'm just like, why is that in the trailer? I mean, that gives too much away. It leads you in a direction, which I think, you know, starting the film, you have no clue what this is or where it's going. And that's the exciting thing about it. But if you know this thing, it kind of spoils a lot of it for you. And I just thought that I wouldn't have done that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I watched Triangle of Sadness without watching the trailer, and I was like, oh, yeah, I was blown away. One of my favorite films last year. But, like, so basically we have to create a system where people are just led or forced into watching a movie with, you know, without them knowing what it is or what's coming. And then it would be the rediscovery of the kind of blowing your mind with something that you don't see coming kind of moment that we used to have. Maybe it's not going to happen, but we can dream.
I think there's ways of doing it. You know what I mean? Because I think it's about letting people know what the theme of the story, right? To build up this thing. You know what I mean? So it's just like with yours, it would be, I guess you kind of be like, you're looking at themes of love, right? And what makes a family, right?
Yeah.
What are the important things to you in life?
What
would you do to keep love alive, right? And you build that kind of thing, and then it's just like little bone launch, right? And you're just like, yo, what the fuck is happening here? Okay. I'm down with that. But, and then it's just like, you know, something like this, like these kind of conversations, because it lets people, because I think when you hear someone talk so passionately about something, right? And it's just the way you've talked about Neil and his approach to the script and his vision and everything like that, it's very compelling, right? That lets me know, oh, these people ain't fucking around. Right, these people haven't phoned this in. They really care about what they put on the screen. I want to check that out.
Well, with those words, that sounds great. Hopefully, everyone will check it out. And also, so we got this like nice. This is kind of our alternative poster about for Little Dawn Lodge. But you can order the T-shirt if you want, and follow me on Instagram, Matthias Hohner. But yeah, so it's been a real pleasure talking to you, Kevin, and I think I hope everyone's going to go and check out the movie twice, three times. If you purchase it, you can watch it as many times as you like.
That is very true. Very true. And how can they purchase it? Is it digital? Have you got physical? Like, what are you doing?
It's going to be released on Monday, 22nd. 22nd of May. It's going to be digital, so I like definitely iTunes, Sky, I imagine Amazon for purchase. So there you go.
Okay, splendid. That's great, man. So all the information, people, is on the website, so make sure you check it out, right? Go watch it. Go cop yourself one of those nice T-shirts.
Sorry for me saying this plug. I don't actually make any money on those T-shirts, but I just like to see them out there in the world.
Fantastic. And do you know your next project?
I do know. I'm attached to a couple of things. They're like thrillers, action thrillers, horror, a horror comedy TV show, a science fiction project. Let's see which one's going to be the one that clicks and happens next. So working on that.
Okay. Well, Raffius, once you know, definitely door is always open. Come back and let's have another conversation because this has been great.
God bless, Kevin. Same, like, definitely. I'll run your door down next time, next project.
Outstanding, man. Thank you for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Right. And thank you for listening. Much appreciated. Thank you. Take care.
Thanks, fam.
All right. Bye.
People, grab your calendar and mark down the dates. May 31st to the 6th of June sees the return of the best love sci-fi film festival out in the streets. It's Sci-Fi London 2023, people. And you know, we have got feature films, short programs. There is the return of Hackstock, the 7th edition, right? We've got Comic Fair, Panel Borders. Oh, so much stuff to look forward to. So much stuff to look forward to. People. You know what I mean? So, yes. Now, what films will be playing? The opening night gala will see the screening of UFO Sweden. Right? That's on the 31st. Then on the 1st of June is the UK premiere of Phi 1.618. It might be pronounced something differently, but that's what I'm seeing in front of me, people. Right. The next day, on the 2nd, is the international premiere of Cade, The Tortured Crossing. Right. Also, we have the UK premiere of Deep Astronomy and the Romantic Sciences. Right. On Friday, the 2nd of June, is the UK premiere of Once Upon a Time in the Future 2121. Then there's also the world premiere of Uzma. The UK premiere of The Warm Season. The world premiere on Saturday, the 3rd, of The Great Glitch. You also have the UK premiere of The Elderly. No, there's not a load of old people turning up. It's a film, people. It's a film. Right? Then there's the UK premiere of Winter Tide. Right? On Sunday the 4th, it's the UK premiere of The Eye and the Wall. Right? You've also got Remote, which is on Monday the 5th of June, right? That's a festival preview. You've got Mondo Nights on the 5th. There's Mad, A Night of Nuclear War. And the closing night gala on the 6th of June is The Bystanders. Now, every year, right, there's a great shorts program. And you know what I mean? Hey, it continues. It continues in 2023. So our first shorts program, people, is Join the Dots. Okay, so that will be... yeah, I think that's screening at the Rich Mix, right? You've got Connection. There's Other Half. Keep, Delete. Cross. Moonskin Fever. All I Hear is Static. and Company. All right, then we have got Beam Me Up, Siri. This is also at the Rich Mix. And that comprises of Sylvie Made It, Interview with Traveller 582, Roe Butler, The Operator, The Virtual Llama, The Fourth, and Take Me to Your Influencer. Then we have It's the Future, Jim. Right, this also at the Rich Mix. We have The Draft, Time Spent, Flight, 10 with a Flag, Alien Nation, Shrapnel, Solitarius Lupius, It's Dog to Make a House Plant If Your Sandwich. Yeah, that's the name of it, people. And also Claudio's Song. Then there is Space Is the Place. Rich Mix again. We have got Dark Cell, Record Play Stop, Solace, Drifter, Fracture, Lost in the Sky, and Defining Human. Next up is Emotional Intelligence, Rich Mix, Suppression, The Machine, Sucker, The Empathy Machine, Radio Telescope, and the final film block of shorts is I think this is I Spy with My Little Eye. No, I don't think that's what that is called. I think it is Silver Sails Climate Crisis. Silver Sails? I think that's how you say it. I'm not quite sure, people. So this one is taking place at Picture House Central. And we have got Homing Instinct, Spa Sibrit, Time Tourists, and that's it. I think these ones will have Q&As. So there is a lot to keep you occupied, people. So do not miss it. Remember, it's the 31st of May to the 6th of June, Sci-Fi London 2023. You better not miss it, people, because it's going to be a blast. Stories have spanned the eons of time, right? We have so many genres, so many types of story, but sci-fi can encapsulate all of them, which is the joy of it, people. And here's the thing. Everyone feels that they've got a story within them, right? You watch films and you think, I could do better than that, or I've got a better take on that than they did. So this is your opportunity to put your film where your mouth is. That's right, people. The 48-hour film challenge is back. Mark it down. Right, the 24th to the 26th of June, the 48-hour film challenge. Now, here's what the gist is, right? At 11 a.m. on the 24th, you will be sent, right? The title of the film you're going to be making, a prop list, a line of dialogue, and an optional idea film, right? Then you have until the Monday to write, shoot, and deliver your film. But don't worry, it just has to be 5 minutes. 5 minutes. Simple, right? You can do it. And judging the films this year, we have got the great Amanda Ray. We also have Chi Kong Chong and Marbella. All right, they are the first three judges to be announced. So stay tuned because there will be more. But people, start plotting those ideas down. Start plotting those ideas down. Register so you are set, because this is going to be another hotly contested challenge. The only question is, will you be a part of it? Okay, people, so there you go. That is the end of part two. Little Bone Lodge will be out Monday, the 22nd of May. So be sure to go check it out. All the links are on the website, people. And how great was Matthias, right? Ah, what a fun conversation. But we are not done. We have one more to go, people. So I will see you in part three. Peace.